Support for the full story comes from the Heart and Vascular Center at Bridgeport Hospital, where advanced cardiovascular treatments are met with compassion and a uniquely personalized approach to care. Learn more at bridgeporthospital.org/heart.
This is The Full Story. I'm Tom Kooser. There aren't enough teachers in Connecticut. That's not news. Studies have shown that for years, Connecticut has struggled to hire and retain teachers in some specific areas, bilingual programs, math, science, special education. But add a pandemic to the mix, and the situation becomes even more complex. School systems across the state are trying to find innovative ways to close that teacher gap. Joining me now is Kate Diaz. She is the president of the Connecticut Education Association. That's a grassroots organization that advocates for teachers and public schools. And Kate Diaz joins us via Zoom. Ms. Diaz, welcome to The Full Story.
Thank you so much for having me. You're certainly talking about a topic that is near and dear to my heart.
Before we get started on that, share with us, please, something about CEA, the work it does and the work you do with it.
So we absolutely are dedicated to improving working and learning conditions in the state of Connecticut and ensuring that the best interest of our educators and our students is always at the forefront of the decision making around public education, because it's so critical that we never lose sight of really the people who are impacted by the public school system. And that is the students first and foremost, and the educators that make that system really hum.
And just so people know, this is not an organization that popped up a couple of years ago, when the pandemic started. You've been around for a long, long, long time.
Oh, absolutely. We've been around since the 1800s. So, this is an organization we have been dedicated to, sort of the teacher picture for our entire, our entire existence.
This week, you and members of your organization testified before the state legislature's Education Committee, I understand. And one of the items that you addressed with the legislature was recruiting, another retaining a diverse teaching workforce.
Absolutely. That's a really critical component. What we know is that every student benefits from a really diverse workforce, and that's regardless of their own race or ethnicity. What we find is that the more vast the exposure of our students is to a diverse teacher pool and employee pool, the better their understanding of sort of the world at large is, their understanding of human differences and culture. And so everybody wins when the workforce is diversified. And Connecticut has been focused on this issue and making, I would say, marginal gains. We're not where we need to be. But I think as we continue this conversation, it's so important to think about not just how do we get people into the profession and figuring out where are those barriers and break those barriers down, but it's also important to think about how do we ensure that this is an employment situation that's beneficial and supportive for lots of different people.
I described teacher shortage as simply not enough teachers, but are we talking more about not enough diversity in the teacher pool, or literally just not enough in terms of total numbers of teachers? Or both?
So, yeah, I mean, the truth of this is it is both. It is both. We are absolutely facing critical shortages. We're seeing the pipeline of teachers coming into the profession is dwindling. That was pre-pandemic, but continues to persist. I think the pandemic, as with many things, exacerbated this issue, really emphasized the challenges that school districts are facing, and really caused our young educators, our student educators, to think, is this really the direction I want to go in? So I think we have a twofold issue. Certainly looking at what is the future of this work, who is going to come into it, but recognizing that diversifying that workforce as we're experiencing this is really also got to be a critical component. It's a huge opportunity for us to really reflect on how we pull people into this profession. What are the placement of barriers? You'll hear somebody like me frequently talk about the unnecessary standardized testing. We recognize wholeheartedly as an education industry, that standardized testing is really not a measure of any genuine success. It might be a benchmark, might be worth taking every now and then, but it's not a predictor of performance in the future. And we accept that, and we push it and advocate hard for that, particularly like when we're talking about our students. And yet we still rely on standardized tests as a major barrier to entry to this profession, knowing that they're typically racially biased, socioeconomically biased. These tests are not a really great gatekeeper in terms of professional outcomes. So we've been talking a lot about, is this a necessary tool, or are there other ways that we can access this profession that, one, are less costly? I was talking to a college professor who works with students, and they're saying that our students can face up to $1,500 in fees before they even get a job. And recognizing that an entry-level teaching position is maybe $50,000, that's a huge cost to access that field. So I think we have a twofold issue, and it's going to take multiple strategies, I really do think, to address the issues.
What would you say are the symptoms of a teacher shortage? How do you know there's a shortage? What shows up in the classroom or in school systems that indicate we just don't have enough teachers here?
So the first is obviously openings. Waterbury is still working with 140 openings, positions that are just simply not filled. So that's one indicator. I would also say that the massive shifting and moving of teachers between districts is an indicator, because one of the things that we know is that teachers tend to get into their district and stay until there's a point where they need to leave, either financially or opportunity or advancement. So they tend to stay. When we see lots and lots of shifting between districts, we know that that's a real tip that something unusual is happening. And we did see massive shifts, people moving from one district to another this year. So that tells us that there's an extraordinary number of openings. What we'll also start to keep track of is class sizes. You know, nobody thinks a class size of 28 students in an elementary school is ideal. So when you see class sizes creeping upwards to those 28, 29 students, it's an indicator that this building doesn't have the staff it needs to properly support the student learning. So all of those things together really start to tell us this is a picture of a crisis looming.
You mentioned during that hearing for the state legislature's education committee that many of the state's poorest school districts have the hardest time keeping teachers. Why is that?
So often that has to do with working conditions. So what is the facilities like? Do I have the supplies I need, the access to books that I need, the access to additional support structures like social workers and school counselors? But it'll also honestly come down to dollars and cents. If their salaries are lower, if their benefits are more expensive, they're going to seek employment elsewhere. So what we've seen over time is often in these financially distressed communities, the wages get suppressed over time. And so these aren't problems that happen in one year, they happen over a period of time. Suppressing those wages, we had wage freezes. Waterbury again had a wage freeze, I think it was 4 or 5 years ago. Those things stick with districts and suppress wages over time. And so when you have that, the long-term impact is you're less competitive. So if I'm a teacher and I reach 12, 13, 14 years into the profession, it's now cost advantaged, sometimes in the nature of $10,000 to $15,000 for me to go to a different district. So often that's really a critical factor. And I also think it's important to acknowledge that even if I'm willing to overlook that, if I'm consistently in an under-resourced classroom, the stress of that is often overwhelming. And under-resourced can either be not the supplies and resources you need physically, but it also can be under-resourced in terms of staff. So if I have a classroom of 28 students every single year, and there doesn't seem to be any addressing of that issue and relief in sight, there becomes a point where I, as an educator, am overwhelmed by that, and I get an offer to a position with 20 students in the classroom and a $10,000 increase and newer textbooks and readily, accessed resources, it becomes a point where I'm really, that's very attractive.
So it sounds like money is at least one answer to the problem, a way to change that. Can the legislature help with that? Can the legislature help increase diversity among the teaching staff?
So the legislative fixes to these, you know, everybody kind of has their wheelhouse in what they can control, right? And the legislature can't control independent contracts that are going on in the school districts. But things that we really have to start looking at are tax credits for educators. Georgia recently instituted a $3,000 tax credit for educators. That's a bottom line, goes to everybody, regardless of your district. It's something that Connecticut could look to do. We're in a short session, so we're not probably going to get what we really need to accomplish. But what I'm excited about is we're starting to have conversations about what does teacher retention look like, and what, and potentially putting together a task force to do some quick work on, could we institute tax credits? Could we introduce incentives through the teacher retirement system, whereby if you work in a financially distressed community, you accrue your pension benefits differently, maybe more expediently. So you won't earn the large salary of maybe our, some of our counterparts, but you might be able to retire earlier. So trying to look at creative ways to offset and think about how do we retain people. We're also critically looking at federal legislation. Right now, Connecticut is one of only 13 states that does not allow teachers to benefit from the Social Security system. So what ultimately happens is that wonderful pool of people who potentially could be second career educators say no thank you, because they'd have to give up their Social Security wages and benefits. And I think, you know, most people, that's not an attractive offer. So we're trying to work through the federal government to fix that as well, because that's a real barrier. It holds people out, and I think that's a real critical pool of teachers potentially, and diverse people, people with a lot of different perspectives that would really enrich school districts.
A report by the Rockefeller Institute from 2019, it said that in Connecticut, the number of teachers retiring is increasing. Meanwhile, the number of people entering the state's teacher training programs is dropping. Is that something you've observed? Is that
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. It's a consistent trend that we're seeing. And what we're trying to do is figure out how do we draw more people into the profession? Even with all of its challenges, teaching is still the best job, and I couldn't imagine doing anything else. And, you know, so we need to figure out how to work people through those challenges, how to figure out how to solve some of those school-based issues and supports. Some of it's funding, some of it's climate. Some of it's just really making sure we're having honest conversations with the people leading the districts. And so I think there's a lot of pieces to that puzzle, because we do need to ensure that the people coming into the field feel supported, excited, and really kind of bring that energy to our school classrooms. It's a huge asset. And so we really want to figure out how to push with our partners, you know, in administration and boards of education and their legislature, to say we're investing in education as a critical aspect of Connecticut's own growth, both, you know, sort of as a community and as an economy. We need strong public schools.
You're an enthusiastic teacher. You say it's the best job. Have you heard from others who are leaving, retiring perhaps earlier than they might otherwise, who talk about the challenges of classrooms, who talk about the challenges of dealing with parents? And they, I've heard some say, I don't get paid enough for this.
Right. Well, I think there's a lot of things, and we absolutely, you know, most devastating to me was the 2019 Teacher of the Year, Sheena Graham, recently retired early, very significantly prematurely from her plans. And she really just said, it was never about the kids. She goes, I loved my students. I loved every minute. But as she started to feel that decision-making became really void of that human component of understanding the impact on students, and she was really stressed out about that and said, I just don't feel like I can do the job I want to do. I don't feel like I can accomplish what I need to be able to do with these kids. And I feel like every day I come in and I fail. And because I'm in a system that is not giving me what I need. And she talks really openly about the facilities not being maintained, the support not being present. When you ask questions, you kind of get labeled a troublemaker. And, you know, really some of those aspects where you're sitting there going, I am a professional. I have been trained to do this work, and yet I'm consistently dismissed. And I do think the pandemic sort of, we saw this rise in hypercriticism of educators from really individuals who don't even know what we're doing and understand the complexity of a day in school. And, you know, we've started a campaign called What You Don't See to really try and highlight that while everybody's gone to school, because oftentimes we get hit by people who are like, well, I know what school's like. And I'm like, well, you know what school's like as a student, not necessarily as a professional trying to navigate and enhance the system. And so our program here with the What You Don't See is really to give voice to the aspects of the work we do that may not be visible on a daily basis. So, because I think a lot of the work of schools, we do a really great job of protecting sort of the story, right? We don't really want to give people as deep of a dive because there are some intimacies with students and families that we're very, very protective of. However, what we know is all of those interactions are important and they take a toll though too. So during the pandemic, we've had a lot of dual work for teachers. You know, we don't have enough social workers and school counselors, but we still have kids in need. So other people have to pitch in and absorb some of that support work, work that we're not necessarily trained to do. So it's hard and it takes a toll. And I think that's what we're really trying to highlight is that we don't just come in and teach a math lesson. We don't just come in and execute and give tests and, you know, go home at the end of the day and go, hope everything goes well for you. That our investment in these students is much deeper. And the student that's struggling with their own social and emotional issues stay with us. And we worry about them and we care for them and we work with their families and we try and connect them, but they don't go away when the door closes. They're with us. You know, kids with food insecurity, we worry about them. Our students that are homeless, we care deeply about how do we support those families? How do we help them? And so I think really trying to highlight that our schools are a really intricate network of support structures for our communities. A lot of things converge into schools. And so we can't be sort of nonchalant, I guess, about those things. We can't be like, oh, just cut that. It's just pencils and paper, you know, paper clips. And it's not. It's, you know, these are the things that we do that help our kids get through the day and our families get through the month. And, you know, teachers are the ones doing fundraising for the kids whose house burned down. We're the ones worried about these things on a daily basis.
The 2019 Rockefeller Report also pointed out that some key specializations, they've been traditionally rather hard to recruit and retain teachers for. For example, bilingual programs, math, science, special education. Why is that? Why are these specific areas impacted more than others?
So I think they're intense areas and some very specialized things. I think math and science has a competition issue. I am a high school math teacher. I would easily be able to take my skill set and translate it into the world of business and industry and make considerably more money, considerably. So there's a competition issue we have, and that's really critical to understand. If I'm a skilled mathematician, I can be an actuary and make three times what a starting teacher makes. You know, if I am a skilled scientist, I can go work at Pfizer and work on completely, you know, much more lucrative projects. So those areas in particular have a real competition situation. When you start talking about other areas like special education and bilingual education, now you're talking about real specialization of content knowledge. And so those people are really, again, I think our bilingual people probably fall in that competition area where they have a skill set that's really highly desirable. Our special ed, I think it's a stress issue too. I think we've overextended our special education instructors, and word is out that if you dedicate your life to special education, you will be really overextended on a daily basis. And so there are some people who for that is their passion, but are really looking at what are the other ways I can serve these special needs communities and not burn myself out, truthfully.
Lots of challenges that you've detailed. Are you optimistic that the teacher shortage problem can be dealt with effectively in the near future?
I think so. I think enough people are talking about this. I think the scariest thing to me would be if I were sitting alone and going, hey, we have a real problem. And there was no one else having that conversation with me. We have a lot of voices now chiming in going, I'm worried about this. Voices at both the colleges, voices at the school district level. In a way, we have partners that have never existed before. Often superintendents and teachers aren't always on the same side of an issue. And on this one, we are closely aligned, ringing that alarm bell together, boards of ed, concerned about what are we doing to make these desirable jobs? Because it's not just that we want people in them. We want sophisticated, smart, dedicated, motivated individuals serving our kids. So it's not just enough to attract bodies. We want to really embrace and empower these districts to hire the best possible people they can find and attract the best possible people to these fields. And so we really are starting to have those conversations at a much deeper level with a larger population of stakeholders, including our legislators, who are very concerned about what's the future of public education. We're seeing partners come to the table that aren't normally there. You know, the business community is saying, we really care about this because this is the feeder group. These are the people that are going to bring us employees. So what does that look like? And how do we partner to support those efforts? So, you know, out of some amount of chaos, I think positive change can come, but it's going to take work and it's going to take commitment. And bottom line, probably going to take some dollars and cents.
Kate Diaz is the president of the Connecticut Education Association. Ms. Diaz, thank you so much for your time and your insights today. We appreciate that.
Thank you very much. I appreciate us continuing to have these conversations.
And we will. Bilingual education is one of the educational programs that the state of Connecticut has a hard time staffing. Joining me now is Anna Batista. She's the president of the Bridgeport Education Association and a teacher in the Bridgeport Public School System. She joins us on the phone. Welcome to The Full Story.
Well, thank you for welcoming me.
Certainly. Maybe we should define what a bilingual program is, first off.
A bilingual program, we have bilingual programs in Bridgeport, and they are set up for basically the students that are coming in from different countries, and they dominate a different language than English. So what they do is they will be tested to make sure that if they're appropriately placed, and then they will be provided with more English instruction than Spanish, depending on the bilingual. We have Spanish native language. We also have Portuguese and other programs in Bridgeport.
Are there many students, would you say, in need of these programs?
Oh, I would say definitely. Our numbers have gone up substantially.
How long have you been teaching?
I've been teaching since 1984.
And you're a bilingual teacher, of course.
Well, I'm a full-time BEA president, but up to 2 years ago, I taught the bilingual, talented, and gifted students at Cesar Batalla School.
How would you say your training differs from a teacher that doesn't have to teach in two different languages?
Well, I think that my training was through the University of Connecticut and Southern, and we always emphasized the transitional skills that are needed and would benefit students to acquire English, which there are many similarities also. And so the training is having high interest, high content background of what you're teaching, and believing that all students could be successful. I'm a second language learner. I was taught English as a second language, and I do believe that my teachers influenced me into the person that I am now.
Spanish was your first language, or is your first language?
Yes, it was. Mm-hmm. It was Spanish.
How would you describe your experience as a bilingual teacher in the Bridgeport school system?
My experience has been outstanding. We have incredible educators that believe in their students. We have students that come from all over the world. When I started in 1984, it was basically dominated by Puerto Rican students. And now, obviously, you see students from all over the world, so we're a very rich, diverse group of teachers. And myself, I'm Puerto Rican, but we have teachers from all over the world also that represent the students.
Mm. Are there many positions open in the Bridgeport system for bilingual teachers right now?
I would imagine that there is. As of the beginning of the year to now, I know that there's 72 positions open in Bridgeport in various disciplines.
Have you ever seen all the positions filled during your time as a teacher, or have there always been openings that have just been tough to fill?
To be honest, since my beginning career in Bridgeport, there has been years where the need has not been as great as it is now. Bridgeport in the past did recruit to Puerto Rico. My understanding is that this afternoon they have interviews set up. Denise Ultra Dixon, Human Resource Executive Director, and she has other people interviewing teachers in hope of bringing them to our district to work with our students. And I haven't seen the critical challenges that we're having in education that I've seen within the last 2 years.
What do you attribute that to, the pandemic, or are there other reasons too?
I think that it is the pandemic, but I also think that it's a cultural shift where women historically used to go into education and they were paid less than men. And now women have the same opportunities. So, for example, if you have a person that studies science in the past, maybe they did become a teacher, but now, you know, they're applying, you know, the medical schools and different opportunities, and they have opportunities to make more money and to have a profession that is also more supported. I also think right now that the struggles that the teachers have are impacting their own lives. So, for example, the 72 current positions that I said to you, mm-hmm. those are unfilled positions that just add more of a burden to teachers. So in Bridgeport, we split students into other classrooms daily. And we really need to provide more support to the staff because that is what the students need and deserve. And until we could adequately fund, especially the urban schools, we're going to continue to have this problem. Plus, this year, many of our teachers were recruited by other districts. I mean, we had districts putting up billboard signs right on 95. So when people are driving in or out, if they take 95, they see these big displays like, you know, come to us, we're going to pay you more money. We have, you know, smaller class sizes. We have, you know, incredible packages to offer you.
Have you ever seen that happen before, that kind of sort of rating of other districts?
I've never seen it. My big concern is, and I've been speaking about this, that when I started in 84, a couple of years later, they had the Enhancement Act, and that was in 1986, and basically the state provided more funding to the local school districts to increase teacher salaries. I really think that is needed during a time like now because, again, like I said, here are positions. We hired over 200 people this year for different positions. Some have even left. And then, obviously, they continue to hire, but the pool just is not what it was, let's say, even in the 80s.
I believe it was about a year ago you testified before the State Appropriations Committee, and you mentioned that low wages was one of the reasons why it's hard to fill programs that have openings.
It It is, and it continues to be. And as much as I've seen teachers leave, I've spoken to them, and they always come back with, they love working with the Bridgeport professional community and the students, and especially the diversity, but they also need to be able to pay their student debt, because obviously they come in with a bachelor's degree and they would start at $45,591. Some of the universities they're leaving are a lot more than that 1 year that they're getting paid. Mm. But their concern is that they have to pay their student debt, like I said. They also want to be able to buy a house, and you also have to get a master's degree shortly after starting your career. So you have to go back to school to be able to keep your license.
It's a long haul, and an expensive one, as you point out, to become a teacher and to stick with the profession. You mentioned the pressure that's put on teachers who are currently teaching when so many positions go unfilled. What happens to students, would you say, when positions are left open for a length of time?
I will be honest. I am constantly, myself as a union president, I feel like I've become a recruiter lately. If I run into a person that I meet or someone I know and they're looking for a job, I'm always telling them, please come and call HR and see if you could get interviewed for a position, because I know our students, they're not getting what they deserve. They don't have that highly qualified person in front of them. For example, I know some of the shortage areas, bilingual, science, math, special education. Let's talk about special education. Mm. These are positions that they're not finding teachers, obviously, to hire them for them. So the students are not receiving that technical training that they need to be more successful in that area.
Given the challenges of being a teacher, becoming a teacher as well, are you optimistic about the ability to improve conditions in the near future?
I'm optimistic if Connecticut considers doing something like what they did, like in New Mexico. New Mexico, which definitely was not funding new teachers as well as they should have, they ended up raising the base salary to $50,000 a year. And like I said, something like that in the urban setting especially would make a big difference, because we're losing our teachers a lot to the areas that can afford them to pay them $10,000-$15,000 more for that year. But you have to remember, the following year they're still getting that much money. So I'm more optimistic if I think people are recognizing that this isn't just a teacher's issue, it's everyone's issue. It's our community, it's our future, lawyers, doctors, mail carriers, everything in life. So we all have to work on this and help, you know, public educators.
Ana Batista is an educator and the president of the Bridgeport Education Association. Ms. Batista, thank you so much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Certainly. One reason Connecticut doesn't have enough teachers is because fewer people choose to pursue that career. Joining me now on Zoom is Dr. Donald Paris. He's an education consultant, and he's trained teachers for 37 years as an associate professor of special education at Southern Connecticut State University in New Haven. Professor Paris, welcome back to The Full Story.
Oh, thank you, Tom. I'm glad to be here.
In your years training teachers, have you ever seen this type of a shortage, consistent shortage of educators?
No, I think it's a national crisis. Quite honestly, it's the most incredible deficit we've seen in decades. I've been doing a couple of workshops and presentations on this topic recently. This is a statistic that may stagger the audience. 2025, there's an estimated deficit of 225,000 teachers.
Mm. Let me ask you a little bit about the measurements. So you see teachers who are, you see students coming in wanting to be trained as teachers. What's the measurement that tells you there is this kind of a shortage from your perspective? You're seeing right. Fewer people coming in?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, most of what I'm doing now is educational consulting in various districts like New Britain, North Haven, and so on. I think, first of all, the university preparation is inadequate, particularly in the area of understanding student diversity. That's one. Classroom management, we've actually talked about in prior sessions, that's a major deterrent. So when people come in, I don't think they even start with a common foundation of skills and strategies. They rely on their personality, their commitment, their enthusiasm, but you've got to have real professional training. And I think that's one of the negatives that's preventing people from entering the field as well as succeeding in the field.
So their program, the university programs, of course, must be doing their best to attract students. Right. What are they doing, given what you're saying are really problems training them properly so that when they leave, they've got what they need to be successful in the classroom?
I think it's multidimensional, so to speak. First of all, there's a smaller pool of people in general, and this is my biased opinion, mm-hmm. that seem to want to develop an interest in a career that is not quite as financially lucrative as other options. And I also think universities now have to cater to that smaller pool of individuals. And let's be honest, this profession requires a lot of talent, ambition to succeed, and emotional and psychological stability to be successful. That's a fairly rare individual. And I sense that when I observe teachers in these various schools.
Do you think when students are on the way in, they're screened properly for those qualities before allowing them to continue training?
Yeah, I think there's committees and all types of standards and expectations. People have to pass through various activities and milestones, et cetera. I don't think that's where the dilemma begins to me. It's more post-graduation. If I was a school superintendent, I would mandate a full 2 to 3 days of August orientation so people are prepared for the profession. And then there has to be ongoing training and kind of what I call social gatherings where teachers can share, vent some of their concerns, and hopefully find some collegial support, because it's a fairly lonely profession to be in a classroom in an entire day with X number of students, particularly if they're rotating like in the middle and high school, because there's multiple challenges with each group as they enter the classroom.
You've mentioned that you consult with several school districts around the state, around Connecticut. Are they telling you that teachers are leaving it in larger numbers than they've seen before?
Without question, the answer is yes. Particularly, I would say, in special education, which is my forte and background, that's a very specialized type of instruction and skill. And I think schools are absolutely desperate for that group of people. And surprisingly, other areas that you might not consider, foreign languages, math and science are always preliminary to getting anybody in the building. So that's a huge concern. And you can't allow turnover. So people leave in those very critical areas of expertise. That's going to have a multiple effect on the students as well as across the whole campus of a particular school.
For those who do make it far enough to become teachers in those disciplines, other than leaving for money, although I'm being told mm-hmm. that's a big reason, are they leaving in part due to a lack of proper training from the university level? Is that they're just not equipped to deal with the challenges that are being thrown at them in this day and age, which are, you know, unusual?
Yeah, I often use the word diversity. Today's educator has to manage a wide range of skills in their student population. So we have a number of students, because of various factors, entering school without what I call readiness to learn. That gets multiplied by the movement through grades as the subject content gets more difficult. So teachers now have to have a mastery of instructional resources, learning to engage students on an emotional, psychological level because of trauma and all those kinds of issues related to the pandemic. So it's a very complex assignment. And I just think all schools have to commit way more resources to nurturing the teachers. Otherwise, we're going to continue to see a massive shortage because of impending retirements. The universities cannot train an adequate number of replacements. That's just not possible.
Can you talk more about that, perhaps elaborate? From what you've observed, what works to, first of all, attract people into the profession, and secondly, to retain them, to keep them in the jobs?
Yeah, I would say I'll work on the second part of that.
Okay.
To me, retention is about having a comfortable, kind of secure environment in the building. That's critical, with resources, supplies, all the basics. Then I think it's more about the mental health of that individual. I've been doing a lot of Zoom coaching where I give personalized support to teachers on that very topic. And I'm amazed how many districts kind of think about it in the abstract, but now you actually have to have a whole support team, including even outside resources from the community, to help teachers develop the confidence, the emotional capability, just the sheer willpower and determination to succeed. And I do think that's how the profession has changed within literally the last 5 to 10 years. You can see a major difference.
When you advise officials in the school systems that you work with, that these are some of the things they need to consider in order to, you know, mitigate the shortage, or at least, you know, help reduce the number of people leaving, what kind of a response do you get? Are they positive about that, or do they say, nope, we don't have the money, we don't have the resources, the state legislature needs to do something about that? What do they tell you?
I think it's a wide variety of responses. And of course, I can't speak for the entire state of Connecticut. That's not logical.
Sure.
But if I can use the environments that I've been associated with, I do think it's a conscious issue. I do think from superintendents on down. But then there's a caveat. If you've been in any number of schools in our state, there's what I call something comparable to what you might label crisis management. There are so many issues, complications, needs, outside factors. Everybody's fixated on student growth and development, which is logically critical. So I think there's an assumption that the teacher is prepared and capable. I can't vouch for that using my background and being in so many locations. So I do think we've got to convince the decision makers that this requires funding, the development of internal resources to manage the problem. And then again, getting the community to be supportive, because much of the research says that teachers often feel either neglected or at best kind of misunderstood. And again, that's a major, major deterrent to their success.
Professor Parris, thanks again so much for your time and your insights regarding teacher shortages in Connecticut specifically. We appreciate that.
Thank you much, Tom. It's been my pleasure.
Dr. Donald Parris is an education consultant, and he spent quite a bit of time as an associate professor of special education at Southern Connecticut State University training teachers. Education advocates worry that the quality of children's education is compromised when there aren't enough teachers. To help us understand how a shortage of teachers affects children and their parents, we've asked Gwen Samuel to join us, which she is doing via Zoom. She's a parent and the founder of Connecticut Parents Union. Ms. Samuel, welcome back to The Full Story.
Thank you so much for having me.
Could you remind us about the Connecticut Parents Union and the work that you do and the work that the union does?
Yes, so I am the president and the founder of the Connecticut Parents Union, where we work with families and guardians across the state of Connecticut to ensure that we're protecting the educational rights of children, because every Connecticut child, regardless of school model, has a constitutional right to a free and appropriate education. And this is a very important topic right now, because if we don't have teachers in the classroom, then our kids are not back in the classroom. And we are definitely dealing with some spikes and juvenile behavior. So we need to get these schools back in the classrooms, and we need to get children, teachers, the resources that they need.
And we're hearing from just about every perspective that there is indeed a shortage of teachers. There just aren't enough to fill all the open positions. Has this been one of your ongoing concerns as a parent and an activist, a lack of sufficient number of teachers?
Yes, because parents have been, as we know, last year we had major school closures. So nobody was in school, not educators, not students, not families. You know, families had job loss. So we fast forward. Now these children are back in school, but we forget that educators experienced the pandemic as well. And so that same overwhelm, those mental health challenges that we as parents face trying to homeschool our children, or what I call schooling at home, and the same mental challenges that our students are feeling, our educators are feeling as well. So we need to remember first and foremost that our educators are human beings, and they dealt with the same pandemic that we all are dealing with. And then the question becomes, what do they need and support so that they won't throw in the towel, if you will, right? Because they are human beings. So what is it that they need? What are there additional resources, right? I mean, are there incentives that we can put in place to attract them to stay in the classroom? Because again, the state of Connecticut is dealing with serious juvenile delinquency issues, and we have chronic absenteeisms. And one of those things is getting these kids back into the classroom. But if there's no teachers, of course, then those children are still left to their own devices. So it's more than just supporting them. It's looking at the whole child, looking at the whole system currently during post-pandemic recovery efforts. And how do we support educators more intentional, I will say.
Studies have shown that school districts in the states, in Connecticut's poorest areas, have had a particularly challenging time hiring and retaining teachers. Is this something that you and your organization have observed too?
So again, we're basing our responses on feedback from parents and educators. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a twofold. We're also looking at messy partisan politics, right? Where teachers are being the blame game is causing a lot of our challenges. Where teachers are like, you know what? I'm not about to be a blame for a pandemic that I could not control for. Same thing with parents. I'm not going to blame the parent. I'm not going to blame the students. No one expected this, but these are the cards that we have been dealt. So number one, we have to work with legislators and lawmakers to understand what educators are going through, and they need to rethink of how they're messaging things, right? And understanding that we are in this together, that to lift all boats, we have to move away from the partisan, hyper-partisan, messy politics, focus on the intentional needs of our educators, and let's try to get them back into the classroom. We may need to revisit those retired teachers, right? Those that have built relationships with these communities, and we may create this pathway that we can get some of these retired teachers. It may be after school programs, right? But we have to get these kids back into these safe havens. And we have to, again, most importantly, remember that our educators are human beings too, and what do they need so that they can go back into the classroom feeling safe. Even as of today, I'm looking at several articles where there are aggressive fights, staffs are being hurt. We have to remember that we moved away, we weren't socializing, and we're social beings. And so everyone is feeling the pressures of trying to reopen schools, but reopening them safely. But also remember that the messy partisan politics, I do believe, are contributing to some of these teachers not coming back into the classroom.
I would think it'd be quite a challenge to convince legislators to back away from the partisan politics and really focus on what you just described.
Right. And that's where the people come in. Right. That's when parents. Right. We've allowed the for lack of a better term, the politics to divide us. Right now, it needs to be an intentional partnership between the homes, because children don't start their day in the classroom. They start their day from a home. So let's support these families, and let's understand that educators have families too, right? And they risk their well-being going into spaces that may have been unsafe and, you know, due to the pandemic. And then the taxpayers of Connecticut and parents need to push back on legislators, say, look at your rhetoric, because if you're not paying attention to it, we will see you in November. And we will vote people in office that do understand that educators need to be supported, as well as the family and the whole child. So I do believe, like I said, the politics is really playing a part in this.
Last year, you wrote a column for Reimagine Ed. You were writing about how you think the Biden administration should address education as the nation emerges from the pandemic. And you wrote, I'm quoting here, "I want to raise two major red flags, the dangers of normalizing failure under this new administration by trying to apply pre-pandemic one-size-fits-all children educational solutions and not centering on children's academic and life needs in public education during pandemic education, rescue, and recovery efforts. I define normalizing failure as doing the same one-size-fits-all children strategies in public education spaces and expecting different results, especially for marginalized populations." I'm wondering, in the year that's gone by since you wrote that, have you seen a business-as-usual approach to education?
Oh, absolutely. Because, again, if we're looking at educators and they're feeling the pressures, and we have chronic absenteeism, we're going to have to explore other educational opportunities. It doesn't mean that our public schools, for those that are working well, aren't doing well. It's just understanding this current climate means we have to get innovative. And if you're centering children, and the fact that we know that we are in epidemic proportions of kids not returning back to school, the question is why? Some parents are still fearful about the pandemic. Why are teachers going back? Those same parents who have small children at home, right? They're juggling act as well. So we need to be working with faith leaders. We need to be working with these community centers. We can open up many of these spaces, get some of these retired teachers, right? Create these smaller hubs of learning. It doesn't take away from the bigger picture, but again, we have to get the children off the street back into these safe havens, recognizing that the teachers are experiencing the burnout of having to come back into a classroom when they still have concerns. So yes, I am concerned that we're still trying to force everyone back into the same, looking for a different outcome. We are in different times, which require different strategies, and they have to be inefficient. They have to be efficient strategies, and most importantly, fiscally sound strategies, because we've had historical amounts of money, but we've also had fraud. We've also seen mismanagement, right? These are things that are taking away from centering children. And then there are also these scandals are taking away from us looking at putting a laser focus on what educators need to either get back in the classroom or incentivize them to go back into the classroom.
You mentioned fiscal responsibility and spending the money correctly. Connecticut lawmakers are putting the state's spending plan together right now. Is there something that you'd like to see in the new budget when it comes to dealing with the teacher shortage? Something that would encourage or bring more teachers, more students into the teaching education system?
Incentives. We do incentives for everything, just about for politics. If teachers need a little additional support, if they need some type of loan forgiveness, right? It's the bigger picture, it's the greater good. And having an educator, a competent, skilled teacher in front of that student beats the streets learning every day. So if we need to incentivize it, partner with our teacher prep programs, right? Are the teacher prep programs listening to what educators need now? Because they're also having to change the way they engage children, because we do have hybrid learning. We still in some places remote versus in person, right? But whatever the pathway we use, that teacher needs to be supported. And so in order to center children, that means we have to see what the children need and then custom design that. And some of that just mean the teacher may be, you know, may have to look at other alternatives versus in person. But again, we want to get in person as a primary if we can, as long as it's done safely. But for me, legislators need to look at incentives, because if you have money to pay for lawyers for these scandals, then you can find monies to support these educators. We need to do better with the taxpayers' investment, especially as we're dealing with inflation, gas prices, eviction moratoriums no longer in play, where we're experiencing families are becoming homeless, where private businesses have shut down, right? Where the family doesn't have that income to just stabilize the home. And that goes for educators as well. Let's get them what they need so that we could either get them back in the classroom. But including that, make sure we are talking to educators. They are firsthand, they are the first responders, in the classroom. Parents are the first responders at home. So we need to hear from educators, what are they experiencing in real time, and come up with those solutions. But incentivize it. Whatever it takes to get these educators back, if it needs some help with a mortgage so they can keep their home, so we can get them in the school, let's look at it. Let's look at the incentives to get our educators back. But including that, we have to also look at expanding educational opportunities. It won't be the traditional school settings, if you will, because we are no longer in Oz. Well, we never were, but we're really not in Oz now.
I can hear how invested and committed you are to improving the situation for teachers so that they can improve the situation for students. Are you optimistic about this moving in the right direction in the near future?
So for the record, for the world to say, I would love to have my fingers crossed and say yes. But I am concerned because we're not very transparent at the state level when it comes to the budget. We are under federal audits right now for where historical amounts of money have become. So I want to be optimistic, and I stay hopeful for the sake of families, because of the mental health challenges of our children. You know, we have suicide on the rise. We have, interventions that need to happen for our young people. So while I am optimistic, I will say to parents and those in the community that we need to work with educators. We need to be working with families, and we also need to be working with legislators, because they need to listen to their constituents again. Some of this executive order power has taken legislators off the front lines for their constituents. We need to get legislators back on the front line, listening to all stakeholders.
Gwen Samuel is a parent and the founder of Connecticut Parents Union. Ms. Samuel, thank you so much for your time today. We appreciate it very much.
Thank you so much. My name is Gwen Samuel, and I approve that message.
And I'd like to say thank you also to the students at Crosstown High School, the Crosstown Explorers in Memphis, Tennessee, who helped us connect with Ms. Samuels via Zoom. As you've heard, school districts are looking for ways to fill the open teaching slots in their schools. Here with me now is Dr. Leslie Torres-Rodriguez. She's superintendent for Hartford Public Schools, one of the largest urban school districts in Connecticut. Dr. Torres-Rodriguez, welcome to The Full Story.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure.
Certainly. How many teaching positions need to be filled in your district?
186.
Wow.
Currently. Yes. And so we have about 1,580 teachers currently employed. And so we still have a little ways to go. We want to make sure that every student, right, in every classroom, in every school, there are high quality teachers in front of our students. And so that still remains our goal. And so we're actively, looking to make that happen.
Is that an unusual number of vacancies?
It was exacerbated this time around. The backdrop of all of this is that at the state level and even nationally, right, we know that there's a teacher shortage dilemma. Studies shown that Connecticut has seen consistent shortages of teachers, especially in bilingual programs, math, science, and special education. And then, you overlay retirements, and then you overlay the pandemic. And so it has completely exacerbated and made the problem even much more complex.
Did the pandemic, in fact, have an impact on retirements from the school system over the past 2 years?
We did see not a significant amount, but we did see a little bump in the retirements. And when we look back at The opportunity that we did get with the COVID relief, you know, the funding that we did get for recovery, and we developed a strategy to recover that also expanded the vacancies, right? Additional positions to be added. And so that made it a little more challenging as well. And so not only did we have to fill the current vacancies that we normally have as a result of retirements, attrition, folks moving on to, you know, other positions within the district or outside of the district, and then the additional positions as a result of how we wanted to support our students.
Given that there are always some vacancies, a normal number of vacancies, at what point does it become a crisis? At what point does it get described as a shortage of teachers?
I will tell you, anytime one teacher that we don't have is already too many when you think about the impact. We want to have, like I said, a qualified teacher in front of every student. And so every day counts for us. Instruction matters, and every single moment matters with our students. And so it is a crisis. We know that the number one, when we think about the impact on student outcomes, the number one impact first is made by the teacher, a highly qualified teacher, followed by the leader of the school building, the principal. And so it really is important for us to ensure that we have, the person, the structure, the resource that makes the most impact on student outcomes.
Could you talk more about that, about the impact on students when there is a shortage of teachers?
Yeah, you know, that we have to look at it from different angles. One is the exposure to high quality instruction, right? We know that that is at the center of what we do. That cannot happen without a qualified teacher and a teacher that is consistently there in front of our students, engaging in the learning with our students. And the other piece is the relationship. There is a relational aspect of teaching and learning that happens. And an adult that's caring, highly qualified, and consistent is a key for learning to happen. And that gets compromised because when a teacher is not available, we have to either find substitute teachers, or we also have a shortage of substitutes. And so that means that their peers, the teachers, other teachers in the school, principals, us at central office, you know, we get deployed and we try to support and cover wherever we can. And that means that we are then compromising, right, the instruction that has to happen.
The Hartford school system, I understand, has a program to bring in more bilingual teachers, the PASO Puerto Rico recruitment program. How did this program evolve? How did it come to the surface?
Yeah, so this is something I actually have been wanting to do for several years. And we did launch right before the pandemic hit. And it actually came to mind when we welcomed close to 500 students as a result of a hurricane. And we wanted to have an approach that was bilingual, biliterate, bicultural, to support our students and their families. And I thought, well, that worked really well. Let's see if how this applies to recruiting and welcoming and onboarding adults, teachers to our staff. And so we did try a very small pilot right before the pandemic. And we did, we aimed to have 5 teachers come from Puerto Rico 2 months right before everything shut down. And out of the 5 that we targeted, 3 ended up coming. 2 are still with us. And so what an opportunity again, now more than ever, to try to scale it. And the benefits are twofold. You know, reaching outside of the area will expand, of course, our efforts to address the shortage that we're having and fill the vacancies in the classroom. But also, you know, educators, example, from Puerto Rico can provide a variety of benefits to all of our students, not just to, right, our bilingual students. When we think about who it is that we currently have in terms of talent, so about 27% of our teachers in Hartford Public Schools are teachers of color. The state average is 10%. 24% of our teachers identify as Black, African-American, Hispanic, or Latino. And 11% of the teachers specifically identify as Hispanic and Latino, while 56% of our student body, you know, identify as Hispanic or Latino. And 32% of our students are, you know, primarily speak Spanish. That's their primary language. And so that's one benefit. And the other benefit is just having, you know, a diverse staff that is, you know, with our students. And we are a system of school choice. We actually welcome students from over 80 different surrounding towns. And so we are committed to ensuring that we have a diverse staff so that all of our students, you know, can experience what the real world really looks like when they're, you know, when they graduate and enter the workforce.
Just to set the timeline, you mentioned the influx of students from Puerto Rico following the hurricane. We're talking about Hurricane Maria in 2017.
Hurricane Maria, and then we had another about close to 200 after the earthquakes as well.
Wow. So there's still a high demand today for teachers, for bilingual teachers.
Absolutely. Actually, that's a shortage area. You know, the candidates that we recently recruited were recruited from the University of Puerto Rico in Mayagüez, also in Ponce and the Ana Mendez University system in San Juan. And we had 33 candidates that were interviewed. 15 offers were extended. 10 thus far have accepted in many of the hard to fill areas, you know, TESOL, which is teaching students of other languages, bilingual, elementary, special education, math, music, Spanish. And so, you know, these candidates will get a comprehensive, you know, package, including certainly competitive salary, signing bonuses, moving stipends, housing assistance, totaling about $10,000. But the core of this is that it is a personalized approach. And that really is what I say is our signature. You know, I know that I have many colleagues across the country that actually go to Puerto Rico and do recruiting. This was going a step further and providing support paso a paso, step by step.
Does the Hartford system do the same thing elsewhere in the United States? Are you that aggressive in trying to recruit students from, you know, the other states?
We actually have partnerships with our historically black colleges and universities. Mm-hmm. And so that's another strategy, right? We want to make sure that we leverage the relationships that we have. And these are two examples, right, of something that we know how to do and that we're committed to doing on a very personalized level.
Obviously, reaching out to Puerto Rico and the States, there's no immigration issue as far as bringing in folks who want to take advantage of the opportunity that you're talking about. Is the school system in Hartford considering going international in recruiting teachers?
I think at some point we will. You know, this is the first time that we scale paso a paso. And, you know, there we're looking to see what lessons we learn from this. We certainly know that one key improvement point from last time, not improvement, actually validation, is this personalized outreach. When we speak to the initial cohort, the small cohort, what we heard was we did not anticipate to meet members of the senior executive team. We certainly did not anticipate to have, you know, ongoing connection and follow through with senior leadership and or the superintendent. And we are already hearing the same thing from this larger cohort. And so we know that we have a framework that we're going to ultimately seek to expand, not only across the country, but of course, internationally in years to come.
You sound optimistic about the system, the Hartford system's ability to fill a good number of those positions.
Always. You know, we will continue to do whatever it takes to figure out how to create the conditions for our students to be successful.
Dr. Leslie Torres-Rodriguez is superintendent for Hartford Public Schools. Dr. Torres-Rodriguez, thank you so much for your time today and your insights and explaining the Paso a Paso program for us.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Certainly. What do you think about not having enough teachers in the classroom, not enough teachers in your school system? Let us know. Email us at tfs@wshu.org, and we're on Twitter as well, @FullStoryWSHU. That's our program for today, produced by Fatou Sangare and senior producer Ann Lopez. I'm Tom Kuser. Thank you for listening to The Full Story.